of March 13th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 96, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, at the Apple Store on Broadway and 65th Street, I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you going to get an iPad too?
I can't. The thing is sold out. I mean, I don't know if you saw the lines, but Friday night, I think it went on sale at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. I don't know why I was surprised, but there were literally lines around two or three blocks stretching through the neighborhood on the Upper West Side. It was unbelievable.
And I don't understand that, because you could order the iPad 2 from Apple, and they would mail it to you. So I don't.
Well, now there's a 3 or 4 week delay if you're trying to order online. So, you know, people were trying to get to the stores and get the copies that were still available that had been set aside for people waiting in line. People were in line at 9 a.m. and before the thing was going on sale at 6 o'clock. And huge crowds.
Well, you know, I saw at least, a dozen in the wild this weekend. I even saw one at the park. I took my kids to the park, and on the playground, there was a father there with the iPad 2.
Oh, did it look cool? Did you ask to look at it? Did you bother him?
No, because I had already done that to the two people at Starbucks that I saw with them.
And what was it? I haven't even played with it yet. How did it feel?
It, you know, having used the original iPad, the iPad 2, it feels exactly the same, except that it is much thinner and impossibly light.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's impossibly thin, I should say. But we do have entertainment news to talk about this week. And in fact, on today's episode, we'll bring you up to speed on the latest Mel Gibson and Charlie Sheen news, as if most of the planet hasn't already been saturated with that news. Michael loves it when we talk about that kind of stuff. And Michael will no doubt also like talking about how Facebook is getting into the movie streaming business. Or at the very least, movie studios have begun using Facebook to rent movies. We'll discuss that more during Inside Baseball. And if we haven't hit you with enough overly hyped news stories by the time we get to our theater segment, have no fear, we can satisfy you with some Spider-Man musical updates. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office was Skyline, the story of an alien invasion of Los Angeles. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. It's Battle Los Angeles, the story of an alien invasion that starts in Los Angeles. It grossed $36 million over the weekend and was number one. At number two is the Johnny Depp animated film Rango, which had a pretty good hold and grossed another $23 million. It's at $68 million total. And number three is Red Riding Hood from the director of the first Twilight film. It grossed an okay $14 million. The movie's fairly pricey. It cost $42 million to make, and they were probably hoping for a more like a Twilight-type opening. The expectations for the movie kept lowering every day as we got closer and closer to the reviews. A week ago, Hollywood Reporter said it would open huge. And by the time Friday came around, everybody was saying maybe $10, $14 million.
I know you sent me something, I think, in the middle of the week saying, you know, I don't see this film opening huge despite all of these headlines.
I thought it would open below $10 million, to be honest. So it's not a disastrous opening, but it is $14 million, and we'll have to see what word of mouth is like. Most of the audience were teenage girls. And number four is the Matt Damon film, The Adjustment Bureau, which grossed $11.4 million. And number five was a new animated film from Disney. Elton John can't be glad about that. This one is called Mars Needs Moms, and it was a disaster. It cost $150 million to make, and it opened at $6.8 million. Now, as always, we say you've got to wait till all the numbers are in from the U.S. and overseas and DVD sales. But since the reviews were terrible, the movie didn't open, and it probably won't do any better overseas. This looks like a real bomb for Disney.
I mean, it cost $150 million. So $6.8 million opening, that's pretty lousy.
Yeah, unless it triples its opening grosses next weekend, it's probably dead. It came from Robert Zemeckis, the guy behind the Polar Express, and of course Back to the Future and others, and it's not a good deal for them. And number six was Hall Pass, the comedy which fell pretty hard. It grossed $5.1 million, but it's at $34 million total, and it cost $36 million to make, so they might be okay. And number seven is Beastly, starring Alex Pettyfer, who should probably revise his I'm a movie star attitude. That grossed $5 million and fell about 50%. That grossed $16 million, and it only grossed $17 million to make.
You mean it cost $17 million to make?
It cost $17 million to make. So that's not a disaster, but it's far from a breakout hit. And number eight is the Adam Sandler film Just Go With It, which grossed $4 million and is edging close to $100 million in the U.S. And number nine, The King's Speech, which is at $130 million total. And number 10, Romeo and Juliet, which is at almost $90 million in the U.S. So did you see any movies this weekend?
I didn't see any movies this weekend that were in theaters. I did see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the 1971 version, which I thought was really, I forgot how much fun that is for children.
Well, then what you saw was actually Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, you're right.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is the name of the book and the Johnny Depp remake. I find the original is a little sketchy, but Gene Wilder's performance is just magnetic. It's so good. And the songs are kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean, there were at least two or three songs that, you know, I know Sammy Davis Jr. used to sing one to close his show.
Sure, The Candyman.
Yeah.
Well, and this is sort of reflective of the world we live in. You saw that old movie on DVD. I watched The Killer Inside Me, a Casey Affleck film. I'm getting ready for my annual Ira Movie Awards night, which is coming up in 2 weeks, where my friends and I get together and vote on the best movies of the year. We do it in March because everybody catches up with all the movies as they come out on DVD and video on demand. But, you know, there's movies playing in the theater, but we're just not that excited yet. And we're probably holding off until the summer preview really starts hard. Then we'll be going to movies all the time.
Or some of those early spring movies.
Oh, absolutely.
But I look at, you know, look at what opened this weekend. Battle Los Angeles, have no interest in seeing it. It looks amazing, but
right.
The reviews are horrible.
The reviews are horrible, and the studio, Sony, had sued the special effects guys because they made this movie, and then apparently they went off and made Skyline for somebody else and got it out in theaters quicker, which is basically the same film with just as bad reviews that came out a couple months ago and did terrible. So this one opened better, but sort of an interesting thing where they would go off and make a copycat and get it out in theaters in advance.
Well, Skyline was partly financed by Relativity, if not entirely financed by Relativity, and Battle Los Angeles was partly financed by Relativity. So you would wonder why they would want to do that to themselves.
Maybe they were doubling down.
Who knows? But Red Riding Hood looked awful. Mars Needs Moms, I had no interest whatsoever. The trailers just looked awful. So when all of these screening passes come in, these all-media screening passes, I just kind of go, you know what? I have no interest in going to any of these movies.
Yeah, the only one I need to see is Rango. I feel like I want to see that in the theater.
Well, that's worth seeing, and it dropped a modest 40%.
Right, and like all animated films, it's most animated films, I should say, it's quite expensive to make. It costs $135 million, but it looks like they're going to be okay once all the worldwide grosses are in.
Well, already worldwide, it's made $46 million.
It made $46 million overseas, so that's a total of $112, $113 million worldwide. So it's a good launch.
It looks like films are doing much better overseas. In fact, Battle Los Angeles, $16.7 million overseas, and it was the number one film in places like Korea, India, the United Kingdom, and Russia.
Yeah, it's still early days for Battle Los Angeles. It's hard to tell how it's actually going to do worldwide when it's just opened up in some markets, but it's a good start.
Yeah, I like the title that they have for the international version.
Oh, that's right. It's called, what is it called?
World Invasion, Battle Los Angeles.
They don't want anyone to feel left out. That's right. So they said, don't worry, they're invading the whole world, but they just started in LA.
That's right. Yeah. You know, another film that I'm really surprised is doing well overseas is Just Go With It. It's made $45 million overseas.
Well, you know, Adam Sandler has proven a really durable star around the world. He's really drawing in audiences. I mean, you look at his last few films, Grown Ups grossed $100 million overseas. Bedtime Stories grossed $100 million overseas. You Don't Mess With the Zohan grossed $100 million overseas.
What did it gross in the U.S.? Because I don't think it grossed much in the U.S.
Which one?
The Zohan.
$100 million.
Are you serious?
Yes. Adam Sandler is, this will be, hold on a second. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. This Just Go With It will be his 12th movie to gross more than $100 million in the U.S.
Wow, that is unbelievable.
And you look at overseas, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's got 5 over $200 million worldwide. So that's, you know, he's got 5 million overseas that have grossed $100 million or more.
But you know what? It doesn't seem like comedies do as well overseas as they do in the United States. English language comedies.
Well, that's definitely the feel that they don't always travel as easily. But some people, you know, Jerry Lewis pratfalls and maybe Adam Sandler's dorkiness, you know, works worldwide.
He certainly does not. He's not treated as a big giant movie star the way some people are, like a Harrison Ford. Well, I guess not anymore, but like a Tom Cruise.
I bet he is by Hollywood.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, I think the people, you know, he wants to have an image as a regular guy. It wouldn't help him to be seen as a big glamorous movie star. But I think in the industry, people know he can deliver. Just like they know that in the past, you know, Mel Gibson and Charlie Sheen have delivered, no matter what they're like in their personal lives.
Funny you should mention Mel Gibson. He spent Friday in court putting some closure on the spousal battery case that involved his ex-girlfriend, Oksana, I cannot pronounce her last name, Grigorieva? Is that how
That's okay, Mel can't pronounce it either.
Well, he pleaded no contest, which is effectively, I suppose, guilty to...
No, it's not, not legally or ethically.
Okay, what is it then?
Well, you plead no contest. You say it's not worth your time to go to trial or for whatever the many factors are. You're not saying you're guilty, but you're also don't feel you're ready to go to court to prove your innocence. There can be lots of reasons beyond your guilt or innocence to do that.
Well, it was, I guess, spousal abuse, spousal battery. The judge sentenced Gibson to 36 months of probation, and he has to complete a 52-week domestic violence counseling program and then perform 16 hours of community service, according to folks that were in the courtroom. And to get into that courtroom, which is a small courtroom down by Los Angeles International Airport, you had to wait in line for hours and get a ticket. I loved what Media Decoder had to say. This is the blog in the New York Times. They said, no one even blinks anymore at the fact that courtroom access to celebrity events like Mr. Gibson's presumed plea agreement are ticketed events here in Los Angeles.
Is that ticketed events for the media or for the public?
Well, for anybody, but usually it's the media that gets there early, because is the public really going to stand in line for hours and hours and hours just to...
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe. and ironically, I was shopping, grocery shopping at the Albertsons food store on Sunday, and I'm standing there with my two children, and I'm walking out, and who is standing there buying flowers on his way home to Malibu?
Mel Gibson?
Mel Gibson. I almost asked him, hey, you want to come on to Showbiz Sandbox?
Yeah.
But
I wonder who the flowers were for, not Oksana, presumably.
Well, who knows? But maybe they were for himself and his own home. Who knows? But he just looked so uncomfortable. And I guess rather than approach him, and, you know, I've interviewed him a number of times, I don't think he'd sit there and recognize me, but he just looked so uncomfortable being in public. Walking around, he did a self-checkout, in fact.
I do self-checkout, too, especially if I only have one item.
Right, so he did self-checkout, and everybody in the store that was in his radius was staring at him.
Oh.
And for me, it was kind of a sociologic experiment, if you will, or observation. I watched him walk out past the Girl Scouts, who were selling cookies outside the store, and they approached him, and you could tell, like, the parents were thinking, don't go up to him, children. And the children were like, hey, you want to buy some Girl Scout cookies? And he bought some Girl Scout cookies. He then
Did he get Thin Mints?
You know what? I didn't even pay attention. He then walked to his car.
Then he ate the entire box of Thin Mints, crying.
No, but there was, I guess, somebody, a homeless person that was outside that, like, ran up to his car and asked him to, you know, ask for money. And stood there in the doorway of his car waiting for him to provide some money. And he did. But as he was doing that, I looked around the parking lot. Everybody's eyes were on him.
Well, that's why it's not always a fun and games to be a celebrity and famous. And it's obviously a terrible day for him being in court dealing with ugly personal issues. And even if you're having a happy, good life, it's not fun to be stared and gawked at all the time.
No, and I think it's very interesting that on Friday, the guy had to walk through a media gauntlet. And on Sunday, he's at the grocery store buying flowers completely alone, completely unbothered.
Well, it doesn't sound like he was completely unbothered. He was stared at every step of the way and harassed by a homeless person. That's why God made assistants.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you think he has it? He must have assistants still, don't you think?
Sure. So, I mean, his movie, The Beaver, is premiering at South by Southwest, the annual arts festival in Austin, Texas. That's the movie directed by Jodie Foster. That's sort of a weird, culty black comedy. And I guess Nikki Fink was talking about whether, you know, he can turn his career around.
Yeah, Nikki Fink of Deadline Hollywood was saying that after this plea agreement, which was for a misdemeanor, she thinks that Hollywood is ready to, quote unquote, forgive Mel for his recent past, or at least forget about it. And I think, you know, if he's decent in The Beaver and it's a great script, so if the movie's half as good as the script, then it should work quite well. And of course, he's a good actor. When push comes to shove, Mel Gibson is a good actor.
But he's also aging. I mean, he doesn't have his best leading man days are behind him, obviously. But Hollywood will forgive anything if they think they can make money off of it. no matter how nasty or vile his comments have been in public, and certainly many of them have been, some people will always look the other way and be happy to use him, certainly as a director.
Well, absolutely. I think as a director, he still has a long career ahead of him, much the way Clint Eastwood is still directing movies at the age of, what, 77, 78?
But no one's paid Mel Gibson to direct a movie yet, right? All his directorial films have been self-financed.
Right, but they've also been hits for the most part.
Yeah, they have. Well, he's done how many? Two, three? Three, four. Three. The Man Without a Face, Braveheart, Passion of the Christ, and Apocalypto. Apocalypto, I actually think, is his best movie. I think he's actually improving as a director.
Well, one would assume that the more they practice, the better they get.
Yeah.
He produced and starred in a film called How I Spent My Summer Vacation, which was well-received at the Berlin Isle Market just back in February, and it sold to a number of international territories, especially in Europe. It doesn't have U.S. distribution yet, but I'm sure it will at some point, don't you?
Well, him as an actor is a very different thing than him as a director. Seeing him on camera in a normal film, I mean, you know, I don't think it's unusual that people on The Hangover 2 said, hey, I don't want to work with this guy. And so I think him as an actor is a much different question than him as a director.
Well, Nikki Fink talked about how Mel Gibson appeared at Ed LaMotto's funeral, and Ed LaMotto was his longtime agent. And somebody said it was Mel being Mel, that he did himself a lot of favors by being self-deprecating and telling some interesting stories about Ed LaMotto. And that he really loved the person who represented him for 35 years.
Well, and that sort of thing can have an impact, can it? You know, can sort of win people back. You know, you give a good speech at an award ceremony or you do something self-deprecating. You go on the MTV Movie Music Awards and, Pee Wee Herman makes jokes about his criminal issues. All those things can help you rehabilitate your image.
I think Robert Downey Jr. is the best example of that.
What was his turnaround?
Well, I don't necessarily know that it was a turnaround so much, but certainly at a number of events, including at this past year's Academy Awards, he has made mention or made light of the fact that he was once a drug addict and spent some time in prison. And it was a couple of years ago, I think the year Iron Man 1 came out, that he was awarded some prize at Show West, and they played this whole tribute, you know, montage to him. And he gets up on stage and he said, I'm pretty sure that on that montage there, you skipped over a whole aspect of a whole 2 years of my career around 2000, 2001. And so he kind of makes light of the fact that, you know, he's had some a troubled past.
Yeah, but there's big differences between personal failings and, you know, drug addiction and ugly, racist, anti-Semitic comments. That's a whole new different ballgame.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you think that someone like Charlie Sheen, who is going through some personal turmoil right now, could ever redeem himself and could ever be taken, maybe, I guess the word is, seriously again, not only by Hollywood, but by the public?
I don't think there's much for him to redeem, frankly, so far, except for one comment that he apologized for that could be construed as anti-Semitic. I think most of his stuff is just wacky behavior. I mean, I know his private life, prostitutes, how he treats his girlfriend, I'm not talking about that. As far as he's not been convicted of beating anybody, he's not been convicted of spousal abuse or domestic violence or anything like that I'm aware of. And those are all, I think people say, that's just his private life.
No, I think he pleaded no contest to spousal abuse back in 1996.
Well, there you go. I mean, he clearly is a guy I wouldn't want to date. But, you know, that's not the same as being convicted and sent to jail for beating your wife or girlfriend. I'm sorry, it's not, you know.
Well, we do have a letter from a listener, and I moved it up instead of putting it in listener email. It's an email that arrived after our last episode. And, Michael, do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
I'm happy to read it.
Okay.
It's from a psychiatrist from Los Angeles who would prefer to remain anonymous for professional reasons. It says, Michael and Sperling. Obviously, as a professional, they don't want to say, hey, kids, I guess. But
yeah,
anyway, Michael and Sperling, as a clinical psychiatrist, I made special note last week about your conversation about Charlie Sheen. While speaking about his recent headline-making behavior, Sperling suggested that there might be something wrong medically with Sheen. Michael interjected with a humorous statement about how your medical backgrounds were lacking and that you shouldn't be diagnosing the mental or physical ailments of television personalities from a distance. I commend you for recognizing your lack of medical knowledge. I also wanted to add that diagnosing psychological disorders is in part done through observation, albeit usually in person. Like many psychiatrists, psychologists, and neurologists who have spoken about Sheen over the past 3 weeks, it is impossible to diagnose him through a television set. However, based on what I've seen, Sheen has displayed some of the classic indicators of bipolar disorder and or hypomania. Bipolar is a disorder of the brain that causes radical shifts in behavior, energy, and mood. The disorder's name is due to its two bi opposing polar moods. Obviously, bi for two and opposing for polar. Mania and depression. One can display one trait and not both, though because behavioral shifts often mask the symptoms, patients with bipolar can go undiagnosed for years. Colleagues and family members often attribute the irritability, euphoria, and lack of energy to one's regular personality or a bout of depression. Bipolar is also one of the hardest disorders to treat, in part because most patients don't believe there is anything wrong with them. Sound familiar? Gene's grandiose statements alone would not make him bipolar. Rather, it is his lack of focus and the scattered nature of his contiguous sentences that best represent bipolar. Ironically, an end result of the symptoms, if not a symptom itself, is that most bipolar patients leave a wake of damaged relationships in their lives, much as Sheen has reportedly done previously, and in what might be his latest escalation of the disorder. I won't go into how bipolar patients often unknowingly try to medicate themselves with drugs, both legal and illegal. Instead, I will close by saying that your instinct that Sheen was suffering from some psychological breakdown are likely correct, and that if there is one good thing that can come out of this very public episode for the actor, it is a wider understanding of precisely what bipolar disorder is, what it looks like, how it manifests itself, and how it can be treated. Thank you, a psychiatrist from Los Angeles.
I thought that was a very interesting email.
Well, yes, it's nice to see that unlike U.S. senators, they're not willing to make a diagnosis, you know, de facto based on just glancing at a television screen. But they're saying, look, you know, when you do observe what he's saying in context, it looks like there's a possibility for bipolarity and you'd want to explore it further in a proper medical setting.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that a psychiatrist is listening to us, I suppose. But, you know, we do have listeners from all over the world and from all walks of life. So thank you very much for your email.
Now, well, they're psychiatrists in Los Angeles, so maybe it shouldn't be so surprising.
Oh,
and
good point.
And I have a friend who is bipolar and refused treatment and has become homeless, and I've lost complete track of them. And it's really heartbreaking how hard it can be to get someone to get proper treatment and stick with it.
Yes, that is true, specifically for that disorder. Now, last week, during our, as we recorded last week, Charlie Sheen was fired from Two and a Half Men by Warner Brothers. Midweek, he turns around and he sues Warner Brothers and Chuck Lorre, the producer of Two and a Half Men, for $100 million.
Yeah, he wants to take it in public court. They believe they have an agreement to make it in private. If it goes to court, nobody will want to see it go to trial, at least, I mean, Warner Brothers and CBS and Chuck Lorre. And I still think they're going to settle, though many other people seem to think that he would have a very difficult time successfully suing them.
Well, Warner Brothers said that Sheen's conduct and condition prevented him from performing his essential duties and undermined Lorre and Warner Brothers themselves' ability to produce the show, that his suspension and eventual firing were required.
And Sheen's lawyer said, yeah, right. This guy was arraigned on charges for the domestic violence thing when they re-signed him to an incredibly lucrative contract. His problems did not begin after that contract was signed. Any issues they had about his performance were already available and aware of for many, many years. So to say that they were suddenly surprised and shocked by his behavior is hard to swallow. And I agree.
Chuck Lorre's lawyer, the producer's lawyer, wrote, "The allegations in the complaint against Mr. Lorre are as recklessly false and unwarranted as Mr. Sheen's rantings in the media."
And Sheen said, "Torpedo away, you corporate trolls were warned, and now you've been served." Which is the sort of thing he says on Twitter. But again, Chuck Lorre has been taunting him in, you know, title cards, show cards appearing at the end of his TV shows on air to a national audience. So, you know, this is not a one-way street.
That is true. And I think that in the end, CBS is going to stop allowing him to do that.
Well, he said he would stop and then he kept doing it. So, again, any argument that, you know, oh, Sheen is dangerously taunting, the guy's taunting him too. So, you know, I'm sorry, but I see it a very hard case to make. But the most fascinating thing is coming up, the Alec Baldwin thing.
Well, yes, on your blog, I say it's your blog because you do own it, right? The Huffington Post?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, Alec Baldwin, I guess you and Alec are good friends. He wrote an opinion piece, and I thought it was very interesting how it was about Charlie Sheen, but like the first 9 paragraphs were all about Alec Baldwin and how Paramount, quote unquote, cut his throat over The Hunt for Red October by hiring Harrison Ford to take over the role because they owed Harrison Ford a bigger payday. And so he was saying, you know, I know what it's like to be, you know, pushed down by the man. But he writes that, you know, the movie and television business are filled with some of the most wonderful and talented people you could ever know. It is also the rock under which you find the biggest, lyingest, thievingest scumbags on earth.
And then, he says, but not the guys in the unions who helped make the movies.
Right.
I'm not talking about them. I'm only talking about agents and studio people.
Right. He then advises Sheen, take a nap, get a shower, call Chuck, go on Letterman and make an apology, write a huge check to the B'nai B'rith, and then beg for your job back. Your fans demand it. You will never win, because when you are as big a douchebag as some of these guys are, they have no choice but to snuff you.
I'd also suggest he learn how to pronounce it and say B'nai B'rith, but that's just me.
Well, that was me talking for him.
I know. I'm saying, Charlie, make sure you know how to pronounce it before you give him a check. Charlie Sheen, I think, would be very easy to rehabilitate whatever problems he might have in the public. I don't know if he has a problem, frankly. He's just behaving like a lunatic and people are loving it. I'm not sure what the Hunt for Red October information had to do with it, but I really was fascinated by it. That's what really intrigued me. You know, Alec Baldwin starred in the Hunt for Red October. It was the first film based on book by Tom Clancy, starring the hero that he played. And it was clearly the beginning of a franchise.
Yeah,
it was a tremendously big
Jack
hit.
Jack Ryan, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a tremendously big hit. And then he disappeared and Harrison Ford took over the sequels. And the impression I had at the time was that he turned his back on the movie, didn't want to waste his talent doing, you know, one stupid franchise after another. He was an actor, a serious actor. He was going to do Broadway like Streetcar Named Desire and small art films like Glengarry Glenn Ross. And, you know, he was above that sort of thing. And I thought it was bizarre. I didn't know what was going on. Was he difficult to deal with? I had all sorts of ideas. And here he lays out exactly what happened. I believe every word of it. And it's kind of fascinating.
Well, because he doesn't necessarily come off as a golden boy during that whole...
Well, he didn't do anything wrong.
No.
He said he made the movie. They were negotiating to do the sequel. But at the same time, Paramount said, darn it, we have Harrison Ford locked in for a deal. We have to put him in a movie. And if we don't, we're going to pay a ton of money to him. He's a much bigger star than Alec Baldwin was at the time. This was his only big movie to his credit, really. And they said, screw Alec Baldwin. We're going to put Harrison Ford in the role. They dragged their feet on Alec Baldwin. They made all sorts of piddling changes. And then they basically made a demand that would block him from going on Broadway and doing Streetcar Named Desire. He'd have to back out of that production. Even though it wouldn't really conflict with the movie, they would force him to back out of it in order to be available to make the movie when they wanted. And he knew what they were doing. He'd heard from John McTiernan that wanted to put Harrison Ford in the role. He was pissed. He was furious. He didn't know what to do. And he finally decided, you know what? I'm going to go make Streetcar. So, I mean, I don't see how he comes off badly. And what did he do?
No, he was just saying that he was depressed over it. And, you know, it really affect his career. But now, you know.
Well, it could have put his career in a whole different mode. I mean, he has, until 30 Rock, he was never a big commercial film star.
True.
Not even close. And he had this big franchise and he walked away from it in my mind. And I could never understand why. So, frankly, I'm fascinated to get this dirt.
Well, Alec Baldwin was not the only actor to jump on the Charlie Sheen bandwagon, and I say that it kind of in joking, because Jason Alexander said he would be Charlie Sheen for you. On Twitter, he wrote, apparently Charlie Sheen has been fired from 2.5 Men. As an act of pure selflessness, I would like to volunteer my services to step into his role so that millions of fans around the world will not be disappointed. In an effort to bring Sheen-esque quality to my portrayal, so as not to disrupt viewer appreciation, I will commence using cocaine in quantities large enough to challenge the national output of Columbia, fornicate with as many adult film actresses as I can afford, I may throw in underage Thai hookers as well, commit assaults in 4- and 5-star hotels prior to trashing the hotel rooms, and finally strive to alienate and piss off not only my immediate bosses and superiors, but the entire film and television industry. I do this not for my own joy, but for the benefit of the millions of people who still don't seem to have had enough of effing Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, I'm getting tired of this. I feel like we're overloading a Charlie. Do you mind if I run through the rest of the items we have about this?
Sure, yeah. I mean, because you could go on and on and on about this.
We already have. Charlie Sheen has a cooking show that he's going to do on the Funny or Die website, sort of a spoofy little thing he's doing for them. One company has released Tiger Blood Energy Drink. He's certainly helped Ustream, the service that he used to launch his online video show. That's brought them a lot of attention, so they're thrilled. And the only thing that may be of interest to people right now is Tinted Sheen. It's a blocker that you can – a plugin that you can use on your browser, which will block stories about Charlie Sheen. And frankly, it's going to include this show if we don't move on to something else.
Yeah, although, you know, a lot of media outlets tried to figure out who could replace – Charlie Sheen on Two and a Half Men, and do you replace him, or do you
basically
bring in a new character? Well, did we do it last week? I mean,
yeah, we talked about John Stamos and
we didn't talk about Rob Lowe.
And Rob Lowe, yeah, we did. Maybe I'm conflating things. I'm just sick of thinking about it.
That's probably true. But, you know, hey, what can you do? It is kind of the biggest television story over the past 3 weeks, and we should probably stop talking about it.
Yeah, please.
But then do
I
you
think
want
we've
to
exhausted all the business angles we can about it. Next week, unless there's some new legal news, please promise me we won't talk about Charlie Sheen.
Do you want to talk about music instead?
Sure.
Okay, so we have one story here in music this week. The rest of our music stories are in Big Deal or Big Whoop, but I found it fascinating that for the first time in 25 years, there are three British acts at the top of the U.S. albums chart.
And, of course, they are Adele, who we've talked about before. She's at number one again with 168,000 copies sold, a very good number. At number three is Mumford & Sons, who we've also talked about a lot. And the new artist that's bumped into there is Marcia Ambrosius. She's at number two with 96,000 copies sold. She's from Liverpool, England. Sperling, can you name any other British band that I'm thinking about who came from Liverpool, England?
Would it be Radiohead or possibly? Oh, it must be The Clash or.
No, they're not from Liverpool.
Oh, gosh.
A Flock of Seagulls was what I was thinking about, the 1980s band with So Far Away. I could have been thinking of Frankie Goes to Hollywood with Relax or Jerry and the Pacemakers, also from Liverpool, England.
Michael, there was a tiny little band that you actually like very much. It was maybe before our time, just. By a hair, the Beatles were from Liverpool, if I'm not mistaken.
The Beatles were Buddy Holly's backing band. Oh, you mean the Crickets. Oh, I mean the Crickets. You're right, the Beatles. Yes, of course. The most famous band in the world. But it is a good sign for the health of the British music industry that they could have all these acts breaking in the U.S. I'm especially surprised by the success of Marcia Ambrosius, who I think her album is called Late Nights and Early Mornings. I've listened to it. It's okay. I'm not recommending it. But I do recommend strongly Mumford & Sons and Adele. Those are both very good albums. It's just a great sign of people getting excited by music.
But we should probably move on to some other big, giant, overly hyped, overly talked about news, which is in our theater segment. Julie Taymor is leaving Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Yeah, I mean, this show has been the butt of jokes for months. It's a punchline on national late-night talk shows. People talk about the accidents, the flying, the disastrous previews, the negative buzz, the terrible reviews when critics finally came. I would like to take a moment just to pause and feel bad for Julie Taymor. We all wanted the show to be great, of course, because why would you want it to be a bad Broadway show? And I love Spider-Man. And so we were eager to see it. And now it looks like a bit of a train wreck. So that has a certain, you know, drive-by appeal. But, you know, put it in perspective a little bit. This woman has worked on this show for 9 years.
Well, she's done other things. She's done other things in the meantime. You know, let's face it.
Very little.
I saw an opera that she directed.
She's done an opera and a film. She's been working on the film for 9 years, on this show for 9 years. She's been working nonstop for two. You know, it's not her hobby. She's been consumed with this show for a long, long time. That's far longer than most people ever work on any project like this. But anyway, I'm just saying, yeah, we're all glorying in all the back and forth. And, you know, come on, I feel a little sorry for her that, you know, she made this. She did everything she could to make it happen. She got it to the stage. And, you know, now she's not even getting really to present it to the world. It's going to be revamped dramatically before it officially opens. And it's a little sad. You know, there are actual people here sweating blood and trying to create something. And they tend to feel very embattled and think the whole world is rooting against them. We weren't. We'd love to have seen her succeed, and it didn't work. And that's too bad.
Well, do you think that Bono and The Edge, who did the music, and the producers pushed her out?
Well, of course they pushed her out. Absolutely. She's fired.
But do you think that both Bono and The Edge had anything to do with that, or was it just the producers?
Oh, no. They wouldn't be able. The producers are Bono and Edge's people. They couldn't kick her out without Bono's and Edge's approval, nor could she and the producers kick Bono and Edge out without being ganged up together against them. I mean, whatever changes made, people had to agree to it. You know, the flip side of my empathy for Julie Taymor is I don't buy the argument either that, you know, oh, the producers just want a flashy show and they're sick of her artsy-fartsy attempts at creating art. Like, excuse me, she was given a long time to make the show. She was allowed every possible leeway. She's been in the longest preview in history. It's basically been seen by critics and been reviled left and right as one of the worst shows in Broadway history. Now, they all got together and said, we need to make changes. And Julie Taymor said, no, we don't. She basically did not want to make changes. She felt the show was basically as good as it was going to get. You know, she was going to tweak it, but she was not ready to make the wholesale changes they felt were necessary to actually make the show a viable property down the road.
But now who gets credit for directing the show? Will it be the person who's brought in, who is, and now the name is escaping me, but he directed The Boy from Oz on Broadway, which was a great show.
Well, it was a good show and a great success. And he also had done a lot of Barnum and Bailey circus productions. But these negotiations are incredibly complicated. She's developed the co-wrote the book. She worked on the sets. She did the masks. She's been directing it for a long time, coaching the actors in their performances. The level of complexity, the web-like intrigue over who gets what credit and how much of what the show becomes down the road, that's incredibly difficult. And, you know, really, it's a legal issue who's got the biggest lawyers, because figuring out the creative elements of how much she owns of the show and all that, it's almost impossible to discern at this point. What piece does she get of the show that's on Broadway? What piece does she get of the show when it's on tour? And how dramatically will it change? So if somebody comes in and writes, if they write 9 new songs, scrap the entire second act, and have basically a whole new show, does she still get 51%? What is her billing? How big is her name over the title? You know, it's very difficult to figure out.
Well, and a couple of episodes ago, I asked, do you think the show would shut down, stop previews for a while it retooled? And you said, oh, there's no way they could do it. It would be too expensive. And besides, why do that when you're in previews and you're earning $1 million a week? And sure enough, they're shutting down for a month.
Well, you're right. They were shutting down for 3 weeks, and it shows how serious they are about making changes to make the show work. If they were just going to open up, they would just keep running. They could tweak it, but they are going to make wholesale changes, and you can't do that while you're still doing performances every night. So they are shutting it down for 3 weeks. I was wrong. They're going to bite the bullet. So a show that cost $65 million is now going to probably cost, looking at $70, $80, $90 million, depending on how much work they do. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. I like the attitude struck by the PR guy, Rick Miramontes. You know, what a nightmare job this has been for the PR people trying to deal with all the constant questions. And now that they fired Julie Taymor, which is not a phrase he would use, now that she stepped aside and a new team is coming in, he compared it to a baseball game and said Taymor was like Sandy Koufax taking the game to the 7th, and then a relief pitcher comes in with a lead and they beat the other team, but it's Koufax who gets the win. I'm like, that's a great way of spinning the fact that they kicked Julie Taymor off her show.
Yeah, well, but you point out, you know, the fact that it's kind of a flawed analogy.
Well, it is flawed because Sandy Koufax is famous for being one of the first pitchers ever to throw 4 no-hitters. He had three no-hitters and a perfect game, which is when a pitcher, you know, takes the baseball game and pitches all 9 innings and does an incredibly good job. So
right, basically,
that's
clearly
what happens
most
of the time on Broadway. Very rarely does a director get shunted aside and a new person step in.
Yeah, I have to question why this director, William McKinley is his name, by the way. He directed The Boy from Oz, which starred Hugh Jackman in 2003. And you have to wonder, what was he thinking, saying, yeah, you know what, I'll take over this train wreck?
It's a no-lose proposition. If the show doesn't work, they'll say, it was already a mess when he got it. And if it does work, he's going to have a piece of, you know, an incredibly lucrative show that could run for years all over the world.
And I guess he'd be seen as the savior of the show.
Oh, exactly. And he has a big background in the circus. I shouldn't say big, but he's done several Barnum and Bailey circus productions. This show, you know, if you want to have a criticism of Julie Taymor, forget all her creative stuff. The flying still doesn't work. Just a few days ago, they still have to stop the shows regularly for technical problems. That's just not acceptable. You know, she can't argue anything when the show still grinds to a halt night after night because of technical issues and the flying doesn't work. That is job one. You know, you have to be able to show the entire musical without stopping. And that is something they have not accomplished safely and regularly. They just got slapped with more safety violations.
By the federal government, in fact. OSHA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was not a successfully done show.
Well, I mean, are you sorry now that you didn't see it earlier so that you could compare the previous version, the Julie Taymor version, with the one that McKinley's going to be a part of?
Well, that would be great fun. If I was rich as sin, I probably would have seen it by now. And that is fun. There are people who love to go to the very first preview performance of a show and see it right at its earliest sort of gestational stage. And then they often go and see it again after it opened and compare and talk about it. But some people love to be there early on and see a show while it's developing. Me, I feel like I won't have seen it until it's locked. You know, I don't want to see it until it's done. And I can say, okay, I saw the show that's been reviewed. I want to see it with the original cast as close to the opening as possible. I don't like seeing it early in previews because you don't know what they're going to change. And I feel like, well, my opinion of the show is really just an opinion of the rough draft. You know, if I had the luxury, I wouldn't mind of seeing it early on. And especially now, this is a very unusual situation. Most shows I don't want to see early on. This one, at this point, yeah, I'd like to see it.
Couldn't you second act it, just walk in with the crowd after the first act is over and after intermission, just walk in with the crowd and maybe do standing room or find an empty seat?
Oh, people do that. There are people who do that. They love seeing just the second act of a show. But again, I have no interest in that as far as most shows.
Right.
Because I
want
to see the whole show. Though, frankly, Lion King, her other massive, massive hit, I'd love to just walk in and watch the first 20 minutes again every couple months. That opening 20 minutes is one of the great coup de theaters you've ever seen. It's so exciting and good. Nothing else in the show remotely compares to it. And it's really just a thrill to see.
So you're saying for Broadway, it's kind of a big deal.
Exactly. I get you.
Exactly. I was trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss some of the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. First up this week is director Guillermo del Toro, who had to drop out of The Hobbit because of endless delays, which meant it threatened all the other projects he had committed to. First on that list was an adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's In the Mountains of Madness, which Del Toro was working on with producer James Cameron. But he insisted on an R rating so the movie could be easily scary, while the studio wanted a PG-13. So now that film has fallen apart, and Del Toro has moved on to Pacific Rim, about aliens attacking Earth. That hasn't been done in like 3 days. It starts filming in September and comes out in the summer of 2013. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for a number of reasons. For a while now, Guillermo del Toro has been this heavyweight in Hollywood, even though he's never made a big smash hit movie. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth was brilliant. I loved it, and it was a very successful film, but he has not made a big blockbustery type movie, but everybody thinks he's going to. And it's kind of depressing because he dropped out of The Hobbit because he wanted to make all these other movies, and now he's not even going to begin filming on movie. He could be working on The Hobbit right now. So it's a shame that he had to drop out the way he did.
Well, you know, I'd say he's difficult to work with, but he's not working. So, you know. The potential for an NFL strike, and that's the National Football League for any of you folks overseas, and that's American football, not soccer, which is regular football. Well, anyway. Anyway, the potential for an NFL strike is terrible news for football fans, and it's even worse news for NBC, which has almost no TV shows that rank in the top 20 except for Sunday Night Football. If that's off the air for weeks or months, NBC's schedule, which already makes Swiss cheese look somewhat sturdy, well, it'll have one more huge gaping hole in it. Robert Seidman of TV by the Numbers said that it could be good news for fans of two shows. He says Chuck and Harry's Law, the Kathy Bates legal drama, are on the bubble, and they could get renewals if NBC suddenly has three more hours to shore up. Michael, is this impact on NBC's schedule a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it is a big deal. NBC has no good news in its primetime schedule, and losing the only big show it has would be kind of a disaster. I certainly don't think it'll mean Chuck comes back, because Chuck is just, it's done. It really should not be brought back. But I don't know why he's describing Harry's Law as on the bubble.
Wait. Do you mean Chuck is done ratings-wise, or it's done just, you know, the story is kind of overplayed?
It's done in every possible way you could mean it. It's done in every sense of the word. It's exhausted creatively. It's dead commercially. I can't imagine them bringing it back for any reason whatsoever. NBC has 8 million holes to fill in its schedule. There's no question about that, but Chuck is not the answer to anything.
Wouldn't they just fill it with, like, you know, non-scripted content?
Well, that's the cheap, quick thing to do, and that's certainly what they'll try and do. But Harry's Law, I don't know why he calls Harry's Law on the bubble. I don't think it's been officially renewed yet, but it's NBC's top-rated drama. So it's doing great. It improves on its lead-in. It's a self-starter on Monday nights. It's, you know, its audience is older skewing, of course, but it's about the only good news NBC has
right now. So is television, but that's another story entirely.
Yeah.
Spotify, the Rhapsody-like service in Europe that allows you access to streaming music free with ads or for $15 a month without them, has just hit 1 million paid users. Rhapsody in the U.S. has 750,000 paid users. Michael, is being the first to hit 1 million a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think it, you know, it shows reaching a certain critical mass. It just reinforces even more why they should be able to get into the U.S. market. I don't know why they can't make a deal with the major record labels.
Well, you know what? We'll have to get into how Spotify pays the royalties and the copyright owners for for the music that they stream. And Spotify, frankly, is a much better service. They're doing some really creative things. They had an exclusive with REM where they had the album a week before its release, so you could stream the whole album if you wanted a week before its release. Now, if you weren't paying, you got ads in between the songs, and if you were paying, then you didn't. So it's kind of on-demand music. It's not a bad concept.
How did you listen to it or check it out?
When I travel in Europe.
Ah, cool.
And I, you know, basically it thinks I'm Norwegian. So, Coco takes over South by Southwest. Conan O'Brien has debuted the documentary about his concert tour at the annual arts festival in Austin. The Hollywood Reporter, for one, raved about the film and said he was funnier in the first half hour than Jay Leno could ever be in the same amount of time.
Or J-Lo.
J-Lo.
Sound like you said J-Lo there for
no,
a
Jay
second.
Leno. Jay Leno. Yeah, you know, Jay Leno, Tonight Show. It also said the movie showed Conan sublimating his anger, but clearly very pissed at what NBC did. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
A movie debuts at a film festival? I'd have to say big whoop.
Big whoop, even though it shows kind of the meaner, angrier side of Conan O'Brien.
I don't think it shows him as mean. I don't think they said that.
All right.
But it sounds like a big whoop to me. It's a film he oversaw. I'm sure it only makes him look good.
Now, if I was a big Lady Gaga fan, I could probably sing these next two lines.
Gaga, 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 Gaga.
Oh, I do know that song, actually. Yes, people are...
See? Yeah,
people are gaga over Lady Gaga's new album, Born This Way, due out May 23rd. How they can be gaga for it when they haven't heard it is beyond me, but...
First single is out.
Good, yeah, that's true. But don't look for an exclusive CD in Target stores around the country. Lady Gaga had done a deal with the retailer, but gay fans were unhappy since the retail giant has actively supported vehemently anti-gay politicians who want to strip gays and lesbians of their basic civil rights. Gaga's people say the deal was supposed to be part of Target's reform and a way of making amends to gay customers, but someone got cold feet and the deal has been called off. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's certainly a big whoop in the scheme of things. I mean, you know, an album was going to have a little exclusive version available at Target and that fell apart. It's interesting why it happened. I don't think we really know the story. I'm not sure if Lady Gaga realized her fans were upset and they tried to spin it as being some sort of positive thing from Target and then realized it wasn't working. Or maybe Target backed out on some of their promises to her. Or maybe, I don't know what was going on, but I'd love to know.
Well, she did say publicly that she just didn't feel comfortable with it. But what that means, who knows?
Yeah.
Turmoil at NPR. The public radio network was rocked by its mishandling of the firing of commentator Juan Williams for repeated violations of company policy and a conflict of interest that it has ignored in other more liberal commentators. Then a few days ago, a fundraiser already scheduled to step down had to leave early because he was caught in a video sting telling right-wing muckrakers posing as Muslim donors that Tea Party members were racist and had hijacked the Republican Party. Now the interim head, Vivian Schiller, has been forced out over all these missteps, just as Republicans in Congress try to again slash all funding for public television and public radio. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because it really threatens the existence of NPR. A lot of people on the left and the right love it. It's a great source of news. If you're ever traveling or in the car, listen to the radio. I love NPR. I don't listen to it regularly because I'm not usually in a car, but it's a great service no matter what your political leanings. And this is a shame.
But what's worse than this fundraiser kind of saying all this stuff about the Tea Party members and the Republican Party, who cares about that? He was sitting with a bunch of Muslims and he spends 5 minutes talking about wine and, you know, the different types of wine.
Yeah, he's a bit of an idiot.
I was just like, what, are you going to talk about pork next? Come on.
Well, I was a little upset by how the media covered this because it came about because of the activities of James O'Keefe, a right-wing video activist, and his previous stunts involving Acorn and the breaking into the offices of U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu and other stunts against Planned Parenthood and elsewhere have all been proven to be either against the law or complete lies. He edits his footage to make it look like somebody said something they didn't. That's what happened in his previous stunts. He basically lied and conned people into thinking there was a controversy when there was none. Now, it seems like he caught this guy on camera and the guy has not denied saying what he's been accused of. But when a guy has a serial habit of lying and misleading and falsifying footage to make it look like there's a controversy, controversy when there isn't one, you should be a lot more wary about repeating what he says on national media, and everybody just accepted it as, you know, a perfectly reasonable source of information.
And we should say that you are a registered Republican, so...
That's true. I am a conservative, you know, so it's this is not about some, you know, I just don't like people who ignore facts. I like facts and good journalism. I don't care whether you're left or right.
Cue the sad, plaintive piano-based ballad with a yearning female vocal. Why? Is it a sad scene on Grey's Anatomy? No, it's the end of Lilith Fair. Sarah McLachlan's traveling festival of female artists and female-led bands flourished briefly in the, I guess, late 90s, went away and came back last year with some fanfare, only to face very discouraging ticket sales. Now it seems to be all over again, and this time for good. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, it came back poorly done and not in the right way, and they messed it. I don't know why they didn't do just a festival, a standalone festival in one location, like we've seen work all over the country. I feel like that could have worked as an annual event. Why tour with it like this?
Is Google close to launching a cloud-based music service? That would allow customers to access their entire music library via streaming anywhere they want. So your phone could play any album you want, not just the ones you've loaded on your smartphone or iPod. Google hasn't announced it yet, but hackers playing around with a leaked app called Honeycomb, and actually it's not a leaked app, it's out there, it's a Google Android operating system. They discovered they could use it in a way to sync all their music with Google's cloud storage. So it's clearly on the horizon. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, we've been known it's in the works for a while, so it's a big whoop. It hasn't happened yet, but it will happen. I think it's not that Honeycomb has been leaked. It's that the music app that works on Honeycomb has been leaked.
I think they installed Honeycomb on their Android devices in a certain way that allowed them to see the app.
Okay.
Oh, it was a music player app. That's what it was. It was a leaked Honeycomb music player app.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It was a music player app that works on Honeycomb
okay.
that was leaked. So does this excite you or interest you or make you think, oh, that's cool?
Well, I think if it's a lot like Gmail where, you know, there's practically no storage limits, it would be great. I mean, my problem right now is, you know, I have all of these MP3s and digital music files, and I have had hard drive crashes where I've had to go back and try and restore or figure out what was missing. And it would be great to store this offsite somewhere, all my music files offsite somewhere that could be downloaded later should I lose them.
Well, it's not downloading later, is it? And I'm not sure if you'd be able to retrieve stuff if it's off your computer. I don't know. I'm not sure how it works. Well, it's not a music storage system, is it? It's just the ability to stream songs that you already own anywhere in the world, right?
I have no idea. I think it's more music storage.
Okay.
It's because it's Google's cloud storage.
Alrighty.
You know, the one thing we forgot to mention during our music news or even during Big Deal or Big Whoop is that Gwyneth Paltrow got this huge record contract this week. $900,000 she's being paid to cut some album.
Well, I'm not sure how the deal is structured, but I mean, I'm not surprised at all. She's been on Glee multiple times singing songs. She's, you know, she's been in Country Strong doing songs and gotten a lot of attention. She's a big name. Why not?
Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, we'll have to see how she does creatively, but I'd certainly make the deal. It seems like a no-brainer.
Borders is closing 200 stores, but they're not done yet. This week, they're going to decide whether to shutter another 75 stores. They don't anticipate closing their small format stores or airport stores, so it's strictly the superstores we're talking about. Plus, creditors are still circling, insisting Borders has no real plan for viability, and looking very much like, well, what we would refer to in the English language as vultures. Michael, is the news of more closings for Border stores a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's kind of a big whoop because it's just the latest in a stream of bad news for Borders. I just can't imagine them recovering from this.
Neither can I. I mean, they just seem like they are on life support in the ICU.
They're on life support, and the creditors are yanking at the extension plug and trying to pull it out of the wall socket.
Right. Cut the cord. Everything that I could say has been said already.
It's the second largest bookstore chain in the U.S. collapsing, and more will follow. I think most major national chains will be gone in a few years. I can't believe I'm saying it, but I believe it's true.
Well, on that upbeat note, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. How will you buy your movies in the future? In the past, that meant renting your movie at Blockbuster or buying it at Walmart. Then came video on demand and digital downloads on iTunes and elsewhere, not to mention the rise of Netflix and streaming. Now, some new ideas are sprouting up, partly because Hollywood is panicked over the natural decline in DVD sales, and partly because the internet changes everything, as Michael was just mentioning. At least they changed everything for Borders. Michael, what's going on here?
Well, last week we told you about some specialized apps being sold at the Apple Store by Warner Brothers. You could download a free app for The Dark Knight and watch a few minutes of the movie. And then if you want, you could buy the movie and stream it on any device like the iPhone or the iPad or through Apple TV to your monitor. You get free updates and new content whenever it's ready. It was a clever way for them to get into markets where they can't get legally right now. They don't have a good foothold in China or India and other countries where iTunes is not available as such, but they can sell you the app and get it to you directly. So it's a good way to combat piracy and get into markets where they don't have a presence. But are you going to search out an app for every single movie you want to buy? It's sort of tricky, and it only works for the big blockbusters. But now there's a couple other things going on. Studios are looking for competitors for Netflix and iTunes, and they don't want those companies to become too powerful, and they want some, you know, some people to balance them out. And the answer that they're finding is Facebook. Warner Brothers, which did the app on iTunes, is now renting a digital stream of The Dark Knight on Facebook, and you don't even use a credit card. To hand over $3 to rent the film, you pay for it using credits, the Facebook virtual currency now used by people on online social gamings like Farmville. You know, they pay to raise a barn on Farmville or buy some new animals. Other studios immediately expressed their interest in using Facebook as a way to get movies and other content into the hands of customers. Why? Why are they turning to Facebook?
Well, because there's 500 million people there from all over the world, so why wouldn't you turn to Facebook? The question is, you know, Facebook is a worldwide portal for a worldwide social network. So is it only people in the U.S. that can see these films, or can anybody all over the world rent these films? Because certainly there are different distributors in different territories that own the rights to those films.
But they don't own the rights to those films in this format and way. You know, they don't own the necessarily own the video streaming rights online.
Possibly not. Possibly not.
But the other big thing is what they're seeing here is they're not just selling it to you. They're going to use the power of Facebook, because when you buy it, that serves as advertising for the movie. They're going to use you as a champion for their film. If you buy the film on Facebook, all your friends are going to say, hey, Michael just bought The Dark Knight. Or say Sperling, for example. When Sperling buys Burlesque starring Cher, that's going to flash up on your homepage. And then when Sperling posts how amazing the movie was and how Cher's an underrated actress and singer and the greatest star of our age, that too will be posted right up on Facebook for all your friends to see.
You see, that would never happen. You know why? Because
why?
I've already done it.
So you're not just buying or renting a movie. You're also pitching it to all your friends. So it's like a free ad for them. You know, if you buy a movie at Blockbuster or Netflix, the notice doesn't go out to the world and everybody connected to you. But you do it on Facebook and suddenly they got a free ad. Boom. And then someone else does it in your link. Boom. That goes. And just, it's this viral marketing thing. Oh my God, everybody's renting Burlesque or The Dark Knight. I got to do it too.
Look,
it's
you
kind
know,
of fascinating.
I got my flu shot. I've spent most of the winter trying not to get sick. So I don't want any viruses. I don't want.
But it's great viral marketing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right. These studios do want to see a competitor to iTunes. They want to see a competitor to Netflix. And it turns out that they're going to be getting a competitor. It looks like a small startup, Fandor is its name, based in San Francisco. They want to be a Netflix, but not for these mega blockbuster films, but for independent films. And they're going to focus on art house fare and festival films, which can't be found on Netflix. They say 80% of their films cannot be found on Netflix. So for $10 a month, you get access to, now here's the catch, 2,500 films. Yeah. It's not so many.
This is ridiculous. The internet does level the playing field. It lets you get in and try and do stuff. But when you're dealing with something like this where you need content, I'm sorry, you're not a competitor. 2,500 films is a joke. And there's no way anyone's going to pay $10 a month to have access to just a couple hundred films. It's a lot if you spend all your time watching them, but most of them you've never heard of. It's ridiculous. I don't understand how they think they can even remotely compete.
Well, do you think that Hulu can compete with Facebook? Or they're not really competing with Facebook. They're cutting a deal with Facebook, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. No, they're not competing at all. They're trying to partner with them. Hulu is the video site which is also making a push into original content. They're all over the news today saying they want original content. They're making deals to not just rebroadcast shows that have been seen on network and cable, but to create original shows that you can't find anywhere else. They want to give people a reason to visit their site if and when, especially, some of the partners who already now put stuff on Hulu, like Comcast or whatever, walk away and keep their property just for their own sites. Maybe ABC says, we only want you to go to ABC.com to watch ABC shows. Maybe they pull Desperate Housewives from Hulu, and Hulu is looking to the future and saying, we need some original content. Another way of thinking about it is that every cable channel in the world starts by rebroadcasting reruns of TV shows and movies available elsewhere. But if they want you to keep coming back to the channel Eventually, they say, we got to create some original programming. And Hulu is kind of doing what every cable channel in the world is doing, trying to create a signature show that will bring them to their site that's not just a rebroadcast of old Seinfeld episodes.
Well, I like Seinfeld.
I do, too. And the deal with Facebook will make it easier for people to share the content and the videos that they're watching on Hulu. So, again, another way of saying share is marketing, pitching, pushing, and selling. So when you go to Hulu right now, all you do is watch it. If you go to Hulu via Facebook, then all your friends will say, oh, Sperling is watching an old episode of Seinfeld. I love that episode. I should watch it, too. And there'll probably be a link right there. You can go right to Hulu and start watching the show yourself. So you're not just watching a video on Hulu, you're advertising that video to all your pals.
How is it that I have somehow become an advertising magnet for the studios?
Well, that's why people, you know, there's laws in Congress right now. People are very annoyed and angry and concerned about their privacy and how much information they're giving away about what they do. Nobody has to sign onto Facebook. Nobody has to share everything they do with the rest of the world. But that's what they're doing. And there's a push and pull between privacy and wanting to share with your friends what you're up to. But there are a lot of ramifications to this. I wonder, are studios trading one dominant player, namely Netflix, for another even bigger one, Facebook?
Well, possibly, but they already have one dominant player, and they love to have two dominant players. They don't like to have just one vendor to choose from.
Mm-hmm. That's always been the way. Internet levels the playing field. That's why people like Facebook and Netflix are players. But if you're going to play in the content world, if you're going to try and offer people a range of movies, you got to have the content. And that, in that case, I'm sorry, Fandor falls way far down.
Right. Well, and you know, really, it's up to the studios to get their content into the hands of audiences. And they need to be doing that, as Kati Chubb said on a previous episode here. They need to do it however, whenever, and whichever format they want. They need to just get it out. Otherwise, piracy will prevail.
Right. They shouldn't worry about figuring out which is the best idea. They should just make it available as many different ways as possible that are feasible and get it out to people. And yeah, they should not be obsessed about digital rights management and securing and locking down copies so that people who are making fair use of their stuff can't, you know, switch it from their computer to their TV to their phone or whatever. You know, right now they can make it really hard for you, and you're the legal person trying to do the right thing. The pirates get the copies anyway, so don't make it a pain in the neck for those of us who are, you know, behaving legally.
Indeed. I second that motion. But that also concludes Inside Baseball and moves us along into our listener email. You can send us email. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And you took the last email, Michael, so I guess maybe I'll take this one.
Great.
Sean Gibbons of Chicago writes, hey kids, you've covered Phil Collins' retirement a few times on the show, including on an episode 2 weeks ago. As it turns out, Collins himself is sick of stories about his quote-unquote quitting the music biz. This week on his website, he released a letter, and the website is, well, you know what, we'll place a link to it in the show notes. This week he released a letter that explains the true reason he's abandoning his career. According to the singer, the reason he doesn't want to give just one more night is not because, oh, I get it, just one more night, it's a pun. The reason
he's echoing our joke, we made that same joke.
Ah, okay. Well, the reason he doesn't want to give just one more night is not because, one, quote, I'm not stopping because of dodgy reviews or bad treatment in the press. Two, I'm not stopping because I don't feel loved. I know I still have a very large fan base that loves what I do. Thank you. Three, I'm not stopping because I don't fit in. This was proved with Going Back, reaching number one in the UK and doing incredibly well worldwide. Four, I'm not stopping so I can dive full-time into my interest for the Alamo. Five, I am stopping so I can be a full-time father to my two young sons on a daily basis. He goes on to say that he was surprised by all the recent media attention of this supposed announcement, especially since he hasn't talked to the media in months. Love the show and keep up the great work. Sean Gibbons, Chicago.
Well, thanks for writing, Sean. I hope that we got some of that across the last time we talked about it, because we did point out that the recent brouhaha over his statements was just, you know, a rehashing of stuff that had popped up months ago. So I appreciate the fact that Sean spotted that as well and sent us to his letter.
Yeah, and if you read the letter, he kind of goes on to say, look, I was making some comments as an aside, kind of as a funny quip, and they were taken seriously, and I should have known better.
That's in the context of an article that made him sound like almost a kind of unhinged.
Right.
This is from like Rolling Stone, was it? Like 6 months ago or something?
Yeah, that he was going to like go and be, you know, an Alamo historian, and he was like that he was actually fought at the Alamo and...
Yeah, the past lives of the Alamo. I mean, it wasn't a single offhand quip. They made it sound like he literally was like almost unbalanced. That's how far they went in their article, I felt. You know, it's nice to hear him talking and saying, come on, relax, you know.
And you can hear us talk every single week. In fact, next week you can hear us talk, possibly not on Monday, possibly on Tuesday. But even so, you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. You can find those links as well as links to all of our social networking sites, Facebook and LinkedIn. They're not our sites necessarily, but they are our accounts. Our website, showbizsandbox.com, is where you can find those. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and as well as links to all of our past episodes, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. I neglected to mention how you can leave us a voicemail. Certainly, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us, 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. Michael Giltz has a website, and he can be found on michaelgiltz.com. That is also his username on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. My username on Twitter is @Sperling, and some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.
Studio, oh.
I don't even know what to say to that.